Most people studying Bitcoin have understood it is a technology which will disrupt traditional finance and the legacy banking system. But what can be less obvious are the roots that banking has in government and what changes to banking will mean for how governments can exercise power and authority using financial surveillance and financial penalties. Our guest this week has joined us for a conversation about Bitcoin's role in disrupting not only banking, but traditional governance models. Nolan Bowerly is a former strategist at CoinDesk and Kraken Digital Exchange, and currently hosts a daily show called The Breakup, which charts humanity's course from a transition on a dollar economy towards a Bitcoin world. I'm Scott Deedles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. So if you're interested to learn something about how Bitcoin's disruption of the banking system will challenge and change the way we think about government's ability to organize society, stick around. This one was very insightful. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward podcast. We are joined this week by special guest, Nolan Bowerly. Nolan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, man. I love being here.
You have been in Bitcoin for a very long time. Maybe for our guests who might not be familiar with you and your work, could you give us like a TLDR before we get started, a quick rundown of your Bitcoin journey?
Yeah, I love it. It changes your life, you know, so I'm always happy to tell the story. So I was trained, I never worked as a lawyer, but I was trained as a lawyer, and I worked for the Senate Banking Committee in Canada. We did a bunch of stuff, but one of the first sort of deep dive important studies that I worked on for the Senate Banking Committee was the money laundering regime in Canada, the FinCEN, FinTrac, as we call it in Canada, what's going on with that. So what happened was these guys came to us with a demand, not a demand, but it was a normal review of everything that FinTrac does. It had only been around for 5 years because it started in, you know, started with September 11th, and then they put the regime in. By 2012, which is when statutorily we had to look at it, it was a 5-year review after the thing had been around for 5 years. And what they asked for was, you know, one of their big things is the $10,000 threshold, you know, that you sign on airplanes and all that. You have $10,000 cash. So they wanted it down to like a dollar. They wanted everything, right? And so we had this will inside of the political sphere at the time to say, this is really bad, right? We can't do this. The reason why we heard that was because, you know, we have in Canada, it's a difference of American federalism where the banking is federal. And we do have state charters, but those are the co-ops and the, we say, Caisse de Desjardins in Quebec, but it's a co-op banking. Now, the problem with them is they can't put compliance at a head office. They're not able to, right? Because of the nature of their bank charters. They have to keep the compliance officer local to the branch. And what happened was we were hearing from all of these small town credit unions that they couldn't compete in compliance for this FinTrac thing. And it was about to get way worse. But then what I found out was that they actually don't even prosecute anyone. So it was all for nothing. All of this was happening and they weren't even catching money launderers. So it was like, let's hobble Canadian small credit unions even more, have them not, because they were saying straight up, like, we have to hire compliance officers after over loan officers. Loan officers are there to help farms and all this stuff. And we can't do that. Whereas a normal bank can send everything to Toronto, the head office, and then it's fine, right? There's one compliance officer for all the little franchises. So all the branches. So this was like a total thing, right? And we were like, oh, this Parisian, because FinTrac is run by Paris, and they were telling small Canadian banks how to run their thing. So it was a very good wedge issue, right? So we were like, yeah, people are going to get angry about this, and they're not prosecuting, not catching anyone. And we actually had permission from Stephen Harper at the time to destroy FinTrac. He said, I hate this thing. Like, just get rid of it. This is the most disgusting thing I've ever seen, right? But through learning in that study in 2012, someone told me, wait, do you see this Bitcoin thing? And I was like, what the hell are you talking about, right? Because I could see the cracks in the system and that it wasn't working. And so in 2013, I got that same committee to do a Bitcoin study. And not like, is it used for criminals and all that stuff? We actually did a study, like, what does it mean for humanity? And what kind of benefits can we get out of this? We brought Andreas Antonopoulos, we brought all these people, and it was a big to-do at the time, because again, it wasn't just like, what's the danger? We were talking about what's the upside of this. And we even did a pretty neat publicity stunt when we tabled it in Parliament. I used the Opportune script to put an actual statement that the committee passed into the, and you know, like an inscription, basically. And it was, Senate committee believes Satoshi's invention deserves a light regulatory touch. And it was a, you know, a big sort of win. A lot of the fake news picked up on it, right? So the fake, it was a publicity stunt, and they were like, wow. And because of that, I quit my job immediately, obviously. There was no more, like, I couldn't go work. But, you know, I think the next thing was like pensions or something. You know, I was like, get out of here. So I was already commuting between Toronto and Ottawa at the time. And I would do a lot of rideshare because I wasn't the type of staff that was paid to live in two cities. So I didn't have like a travel budget. I chose to and only had to go to Parliament when Parliament sat. So I just lived in Toronto and traveled up, sort of slept on couches. And I had an apartment. But I did rideshare for people to save on gas money. And I picked a bunch of people up while the study had started in downtown Toronto. But it was right next to the original like ATM for, and I thought I was like one of the only people who knew about Bitcoin. And I was like, what's going on here? Right? The big Bitcoin sign. I come in and Vitalik Buterin was sitting at a chair, and I knew who he was because Bitcoin Magazine already existed. He was writing Bitcoin Magazine and the Ethereum paper there. All these people that were there, I got them all involved in the study. And so when I quit my job, I went and worked in that co-working space. And from there, I got in touch with the original CoinDesk team that was coming to New York. They were being bought and moved to New York. So in 2015, 2016, I started working with the original CoinDesk team. I moved to New York City. I did CoinDesk thing for years. I stayed at CoinDesk until the pandemic. And at the pandemic, I started doing my own thing almost completely. So I had a little bit of work with Kraken, where my law skills were used on the banking charter there. And I started programming Bitcoin Magazine show because I had, of course, gone more into the Bitcoin world. And because Bitcoin Magazine was willing to do a live event in 2021, the Miami show. And that was kind of an idea that I had at the time, that if you'd go to a Bitcoiners didn't have much adjustment when it came to COVID. They were willing to meet publicly. So all you had to do was put a bucket out and catch the rain and they would come. And basically, I would work for anyone who was willing to do that at the time. So big success over at Bitcoin Magazine. That event took off and it was a huge hit. And since then, I've been running a daily show called The Breakup. And it's sort of my take on what I can do for news individually, things that wouldn't have worked in a corporate news environment, like even at CoinDesk or even in some instances at Bitcoin Magazine. So I do the show on my own. It's about contrasting the fiat world with the Bitcoin world. And instead of saying, you know, buy Bitcoin because of this and that, it's more like sell dollars because this is so stupid. All right. So it's the other side of the trade, right? There's two sides to buying Bitcoin. It's selling your dollars. So my show is more about why you ought to sell dollars because of the dog shit inherent in its propagation. Right.
And it's truly prolific. Is it 5 times a week that you do the breakup or 7 or?
I've done it 7. Yeah, usually 5, usually just weekdays now, simply because the news on the weekends is a little light. And my show requires, I could still do it 7, but really I did it 7 for about half a year when I first started. But I have little kids and I had always spent mornings with my little kids. Even when I was living in New York, I was never going to the office. I was not one of those people. I'm a Bitcoiner, right? So I was strolling in at like 10 a.m. in New York. And we were the original team. So there's a lot of benefits that come with that. So, you know, I was never into that kind of stuff. My kids got a little jealous of all the time. So I turned weekends into kid time. And it's the good energy in the morning. So I have to sort of share it with them. So we do it 5 days a week. But again, there could be times. Yesterday, I was coming back from a weekend camping trip. And I missed yesterday morning because I just didn't know what was going on. The world. I got in late Thursday, Sunday night. It's a holiday in Quebec yesterday. It's our Fête Nationale, as we say, the Saint Jean Baptiste, the old Catholic feast day for Saint John the Baptist, which is the national holiday.
Yeah, I wanted to maybe as a sidebar come back to the first thing you said. I think it's interesting that you started at the very start with FinTrack, because I feel like the average person has no idea that any money laundering really has nothing to do with any money laundering at all and everything to do with sort of financial surveillance.
Yeah, well, that's been the case actually since, you know, a lot of people say what happened in 1971, right? You know, the what happened in 71 meme that's pretty big in Bitcoin. That's the end of the gold standard thing. Well, the truth is, it's not really that. It's what happened in 64 is the more important question. What happened in 64 is at the end of 63, of course, America lost civilian control of the military and the government, right? Because they killed him. Kennedy was dead, right? And so what happened after was LBJ took over. Instantly, the Gulf of Tonkin fake news, false flag launched the Vietnam War. Now, they were very concerned about where protest was coming from, why people were protesting, what the protest was, what was up with that. And so the original instances of money laundering, the money laundering regime actually goes back to 64. Where do the Vietnam protesters come from? Who's funding them? What's going on with that? So that's where bank privacy comes into place, the Bank Privacy Act in America. That's the start of this. That's the start of being able to, that's the end of financial flow being inherently private. That was the original Patriot Act predicate, right? We need to protect American democracy. And so we have to look at the information of money flowing because it's information for the sake of information about the most important asset in the world, money. And so truthfully, 71 was important, but SWIFT, the messaging system, the correspondent banking relationships, the Bank Privacy Act, all of that goes back to 64 in order to cover up what happened in 63 and to deal with the ramifications of what happened in 63. Why are people asking questions? Why aren't they just down with this Vietnam thing? We're going to make a bunch of money. Why is everyone complaining, right? So that's where that stuff comes from. So FATF was set up as a result of that, right? That's where these things start getting implemented. So when they say what happened in 71, it's more like what happened in 64. And 64 is the beginning of financial surveillance as a sort of unquestionable duty that governments have to form. And if you go back in time, like Caitlin Long says this all the time, nothing to do with, you know, FinTrack or FinCEN, it's the Bank Privacy Act that we have to get to. That's the origin of these predicates. That's where the stuff comes from. And that's what it looks like to me. It's information for the sake of information about the most important asset in the world and has nothing to do with money laundering. And indeed, I was able to get both liberals and conservatives on that committee furious. I mean, furious, especially liberals, actually, right? Because this kind of thing actually insults their, not just intelligence, it makes them liars. And then like most liberals, right? Most liberals do, like most conservatives, want a better world. I'll give them that, right? And when they think that there's, and they're very easy to believe in financial corruption, right? The banks are predators, that's a very easy meme for left-wing people to understand. So when I was able to prove to them that all they were asking for, all the surveillance they were asking for, had nothing to do with stopping the crime and had everything to do with spying on people, it got them just as mad. Once they saw the truth about it, they got very angry. And so it was both liberals and conservatives at the time who were furious in unison, unanimity, furious against the bureaucrats pushing this stuff. They got nothing. It's a strange story. The history almost got changed. They knew what I was up to, the bureaucrats, the RCMP, and they knew exactly what was going on. And my job at the time, you know, it's not as nothing in our democracies work the way people on the outside think. The way the executive branch functions in Canada, and it has been this way forever, is that the Stephen Harper's office, or now Justin Trudeau's office, has people like me that would work in these committees to make sure that what comes out of the committee aligns with what the executive branch wants, right? None of this stuff really works in a separation of powers. Like, we're all doing our jobs and, you know, keeping it all sanctimonious and consistent. That's not happening, right? My job was to keep, to use the work of the committee to serve talking points that the executive branch wanted, right? That was an important thing. And so we were able at the time already, you know, they knew what the RCMP and the FBI knew what I was up to. They knew I was manipulating both liberals and conservatives and was basically feeding everyone the talking points on all the committee that served the executive branch, even though it was true. So the only reason we didn't destroy it, I had them all ready to destroy FinTrack in 2012. I mean, ready. They had to do a private meeting, which I've never seen before, never seen since, where I was specifically excluded. So were all staffers, only the senators, no transcribers, nobody. Private room. And that was their hearing for the day. And they came out not convinced, but they came out not willing to kill it. Now, what did they tell them? I mean, something along the lines of, these are our methods. We don't want to share the methods. What these things do is they push the criminals into our little net where we catch them. And it's all bullshit, right? None of that was true. But they were able to create a scenario, which was instead of asking for all the extra stuff that they wanted, they went back to just saying, let's keep everything the same. Let's just keep it the same. And so the senators were okay with that in the end. And anyway, I wasn't a dog on a bone for it at the time because I was already going psycho for a bit. I didn't care, you know, like we all know, once it infects you, the virus, you're just like, what? Like, okay, whatever, you know, I'm already on to another. And I was on to what the guy actually said to me, right? Which was very simple, which was wait until you see Bitcoin. None of this will matter anyway. And that's where I immediately had this idea that policing was going to go back to the police. That's one of the first things I had understood from Andreas Antonopoulos, that's the trick, right? Why should you deputize banks to do the police's job because they're incompetent, because they couldn't catch Al Capone? Like that's enough of an excuse to change our entire system. It's ridiculous. Police have to go do their jobs, catch it, the money launderers. Like, sorry, you can't use this trick and it's inconvenient of spying on everybody. Sorry, that didn't work. I know you want a camera on everyone's house to see if they have a gun because guns, you know, according to you, kill people. But it's not going to work with us, right? It's true. It would take the murder rate down if you had cameras on everything and everyone who had a gun, of course. But that's not the world we're going to live in. So I was already on to that sort of train of thought, and I used a lot of what Andreas. That's how I got interested in him enough to bring him in 2014 to talk in the same Senate room where we did all these hearings, was because of that idea that they deputized the banks, they'd made the banks police officers more or less, or investigative units. I don't think the banks have a natural inclination to want to do that, but they've been forced into doing it, and I guess they get paid for it or something. But anyway, they do get a bit of a bounty when they catch money launderers, but it's not enough. And the bounty is nowhere near what it could be, right? Bounties are really the way to do it. You give bounties to the police and say, catch them, right? And if you catch $1 billion of money laundering and you get to keep 50 million, you're going to get a lot of motivated people to find the money launderers. Much better than some nerd compliance officer sitting in a co-op in rural Quebec saying, did that farmer, you know, send $10,001, right, to the seed? Whatever guy of whatever, whatever. So, you know, that concept and what was going on at the time was very important. And we almost destroyed it. It was very close. Very close. It's one of my regrets. I wish we would have.
It's an insidious limitation because as currency debases, the value of the $10,000 is eroded continuously. So, you know, it was a pretty significant amount of money, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Over a long enough period of time. In the year of the ECB, I think they've lowered it to like 3,000 and they're trying to get it down to 400 euros.
Australia's a buck. Australia's a dollar. Or maybe even a penny. Like the least amount you could. Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. Australia knows every dollar, every bit of money into the continent and every bit out. That's what these people wanted. Because it's a consistent system. That's what they wanted. Everyone was asking for the Australia system at the time, which is everything. All of the money. All of it's true. Everything.
Yeah. And, you know, it really is.
And there's even a crazier story to this. I mean, we don't even realize what we've done. I was just in Hong Kong with the Bitcoin Magazine show, and we had quite a bit of content around this. I mean, do we even realize that this FATF thing, right, that is the guide of FinTrack and FinCEN, and FinTrack is called FinCEN in the United States, the multinational organization that runs it out of Paris called FATF, the financial action task, something, something. So what happened was the presidency rotates between member countries. In 2019, June 2019, so 5 years ago or right now, China took its turn as the head of FATF. And the first thing they did was they named and shamed, which is what they do. They named and shamed Hong Kong for not having extradition for money laundering to mainland China. That's the predicate that Carrie Lam, the CEO and mayor of Hong Kong, used to say we need to have extradition from Hong Kong to mainland China, thereby making China's law applicable to everyone in Hong Kong. Because if you can extradite a Hong Kongese to China, they're under Chinese law now. And the paper she used, the predicate she used, the excuse she used was what FATF had said, which was coincidentally being run by China at the time. So she said, look, they're not catching money launderers. It's a money laundering hub, that Hong Kong. That's why we need extradition. We need it for the money launderers. That was actually it. It was the FATF predicate for money launderers that created the special security law for extradition of Hong Kong people to mainland China to face justice there, but it applies to every crime. But the predicate was the money laundering one. That was the spearhead. So imagine, to maintain the consistency of FATF, we just said, fuck you, Hong Kong. Get the fuck out of here. You don't get your stupid rights. You're a shithole now. You're a shithole. Get out of here. You were as bad as can. And a Canadian helped do it, right? It was a disgusting Canadian, Beverly McLaugh, who helped make this possible. So imagine there's Canadians out there robbing people of their inherent common law rights, right? That's an inherent common law right. That's habeas corpus. So the freedom of your body to not be imprisoned without rightful charges, just abdicated. Money, come on, the money laundering. Get rid of everything. No. Just get rid of it. Go. Give all the power to China. They've been money laundering. What are you going to do? You know, it's ridiculous.
And it makes me think about last week, Saylor was talking about how they're going to wrap Bitcoin in a mainland Chinese Bitcoin ETF. And so the idea is that the Chinese government is okay with people having exposure to the asset. And what they're not okay with is the concept that it could be borderless money that can leave mainland China at any time. And he says some things sometimes that make me pause, and that was definitely one of them.
It'll happen. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with this prediction.
Yeah, I wonder how much the average person...
It'll only last as far as China can last, though, or the governance model that China has.
Why don't you expand on that idea?
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got America undergoing tremendous change right now, right? But the change that America is undergoing is affecting the whole world. And part of that is you see the lack of appetite for U.S. bonds. You're seeing it in China. They're dumping the U.S. bonds, U.S. debt, right? Now, the order that we've all understood was that everyone can be a manufacturing nation as long as they manipulate their currency so that America's is enough to buy all the shit they produce, right? That's been done forever now. That's why Japan buys the T-bills. That's why Korea buys the T-bills. That's why China does it. I lived over there and it surprised me. So I got a lesson in this. I lived in South Korea and Japan before I was a lawyer. My first gig as a lawyer was over there. Not even a lawyer, just a guy who graduated from law school that worked in a law office as a first job, right? So, but this is what surprised me was you meet someone, you know, you meet a girl and she would ask you, well, what do you do with your check, your pay, right? What do you do with your pay? When are you planning on converting it to dollars? And I said, what do you mean? I do it right away. She's like, you don't time it? And I was like, what are you talking about? Time it. It's like, yeah, the rate changes so much and we know when the government's going to change it. So we just wait for them to devalue and make sure we sell before. And if it goes the other way, we go back. And I was like, what? And this is a thing that everyone does over there, right? Because they're so used to it. They're so used to the government manipulating their currency. But they all had an understanding of foreign exchange and shorting and longs, all that stuff in order to manage your own government's influence on the money. So now that's gone, right? Countries aren't going to be doing this as much anymore. Or at least Japan had to have our own help doing it. America had to help Japan buy the bonds the other day, right? China's getting rid of them. So the point is, and the reason why this thing worked, the linchpin of all of this was that the only market for oil in the world was the US dollar. So because that was a closed market, because that's what the petrodollar guaranteed with Saudi, which ended 2 weeks ago, right? They would only sell in US dollar.
Very quietly ended 2 weeks ago.
Very quietly, yeah. America, fought the Iraq war, for example, over Saddam Hussein selling oil for euros. That was a no-no, right? You can't do that. And so because it's been a closed market and the price of oil has only been fixed in dollars forever, that's the reference rate, right? Every other country had to get dollars to buy it. Every other country had to have an appetite for dollars to buy it, but that's gone. So what you're going to see is BRICS is going to attempt to make a new reference for oil. It's another shit coin that it's not going to be credible. It's going to be stupid, right? It's going to be like, oh, sure. Yeah. The very credible Chinese, Russians, and Brazilians and Indians were so awesome at created currencies. Everybody knows, and they're going to create a great one that we're all going to find credible, and we're actually going to price oil in it, and which is the foundational data point for the whole economy, right? Sure, no problem. So that's not going to happen either. And I've always believed, and I continue to believe. Now, I know a lot of Bitcoiners want to hear, oh, plebs will have all the Bitcoin, and then the world will flip because there's enough plebs with Bitcoin. Unfortunately, COVID underline that I don't ever think that's going to happen, or it will, but in decades, right? Where it's just because everyone in the world sees it in Bitcoin and whatever. Not really the way I see it. Never really the way I thought it was going to go to begin with. We were going to get the rich people, right? As in like what a rich people think is rich, having a lot of Bitcoin. That's going to be the definition of rich. You're not going to be able to say, oh, I have this many dollars, and people are going to go, wow, rich. It won't make any sense, right? Bitcoin. But more importantly, and this is where the psychological part of Bitcoin, Bitcoin is a psychological commodity, right? Its value is just based on what you and I think it's worth, that like literally in our brains, right? You can tell me all, oh, the proof of work, but that just supports the psychological argument. We have more confidence in it because of those things, but it's still psychological. It means nothing that proof of work is the foundation in a material sense. It just gives us confidence to know the system works because it's a security feature, right? So that allows us to have a psychological belief in what we're seeing and therefore valuing it to the way we value it, to the extent that we value it. The dollar is a psychological commodity as well. And like all psychological commodities, there's a kind of engine to it, right? It's got to perpetuate forward. It's a type of psychological engine. And that's what a healthy economy looks like. People making deals, securing commercial relationships, making money plus plus, right? That's how it's supposed to work. Net benefit, right? Not zero sum. That's what we're looking for. So the way I see it going in the future is simply this, that oil psychologically needs a reference. The reference is Bitcoin. The price of oil is Bitcoin and is measured in Bitcoin. It will be measured in Bitcoin. The US dollar will not be good for it. The foreign currencies will not be good for it. Once energy is priced and energy markets are priced in Bitcoin, the game is actually over. We've won, right? Because from then on, Bitcoin acts like Celsius in the metric system. It's just a measuring stick for everything. It is literally how you think about money and how you think about the economy. That's the way forward. The way forward is getting the richest and corrupting them with what we know will corrupt them, greed and the normal human things that Satoshi expects of us, right? Or expected of us. So once you start seeing that the big commodity players who really run the world, they really run the world. Whatever is going on in Ukraine is mostly about oil. So once you see that, once you understand that the energy companies don't even have to measure just oil in Bitcoin anymore, Bitcoin is actually a great finance vehicle for nuclear reactors. You're going to see all of energy go onto a Bitcoin standard first. Once, and this is where the communists and the economists get it wrong, right? They think energy is just like another input, right? It's like we made ball bearings and oil, right? No. The economy is energy. That's the economy. How do you express it? Joules is not that good, right? You can't really measure an economy in joules necessarily. Measuring it in money is better because it's a type of barter, or gets out of the barter system. It's a political reference, a neutral reference. That's where you want to see money, right? And so by having oil simply measured in Bitcoin, expressed in terms of Bitcoin, will create such a destabilizing situation for nation states that I don't think China makes it through this, right? I just can't imagine. I think China isn't due for another revolution. And I think they're going to do great. I'm very bullish on China, very bullish on China, and a changed governance system. But I'll be honest, look, the truth is over in China right now, their CBDC is working, their social credit is working. It's working, all right? The people are not spitting on the ground everywhere. Things have changed over there. Really, they've changed. And people have been manipulated by this. I can see it coming here. I really can. I think we are going to still use this stuff. I think all the sludge people, all the people that can't understand what's happening are going to, I'm the only Bitcoiner that's saying we need UBI and we need CBDCs. I'm the only one. Now, it's not for us, right? What are we going to do with the sludge people? What are we going to do with the journalists at the CTV and the Globe and Mail? Can't kill them. Right? I don't want to kill anybody. I don't want to be in like a, and I don't want them suffering either. What are we going to do with them? Right? They're not going to fix their brains. That's finished. That's over. Right? But we can definitely give them a thing where if they like, you know, some kind of incentive trap, right? If they work extra hard, their vacation goes down, right? If they work extra hard with their UBI and their CBDC, they can get the bigger cockroaches cooked in seed oils, right? So we're going to create this kind of an incentive structure for them around CBDCs. And let's see, right? Don't want to kill them, though. Can't kill them, right?
There's to sort of like put a bow on the idea of pricing energy in Bitcoin, which I do think is makes a ton of sense for the listeners. Is this an interesting idea that, you know, so the counter, you know, if somebody listening might wonder, why would anyone do this? energy is this weird thing where energy producers produce something of genuine value and then have to then turn around and trade it for something that's printed out of thin air. And it's that thing that is the part that doesn't make sense for the producers of energy.
Yeah. And we can change their ideas about global peace and everything, right? That they see the path the way they see it, because how else are they going to expand their markets? If you're an American energy company and the US military is saying, we're going to go ransack Russia, and you're saying, the best option, but what do I get? And they say, you get the whole market. And you go, okay. But now the cost benefit might not be there.
Yeah, even when, aspects of why that conflict has unfolded the way it has have to do with the United States' ability to freeze U.S. treasuries and Russian banks, which is another thing that sort of in a post-Bitcoin world is impossible.
Do it more. I want them to give it to Ukraine next. Please, give it. Buy weapons with it or something crazy.
Yeah, they just might.
It's hilarious. Perfect. I don't want to laugh at the misery, but what else are you supposed to do? You know.
So you talk a lot about, you know, this sort of period of political transition that we're in right now. And actually, I became kind of introduced to you earlier this spring at the Canadian Bitcoin Conference in Montreal. And the first thing I heard you say was something to the effect of the Canada that we grew up in is gone. And just wondering if you could. You know, love to hear your thoughts on the state of things today. You know, as this transition of money and politics radiates outwards, like, what else are you?
Well, I mean, there's brainwashing everywhere. Bitcoiners have our own brainwashing. We have our own brainwashing is even the wrong way to think about it, right? We have our own sort of collective unconscious. We have our own fears that are sort of generally shared amongst us, let's say, right? Like, what's a fear Bitcoiners have, right? Being a shitcoiner, right? Being a scammer, going out and scamming, right? We have a fear of leadership. We have a fear of people being heroes and trying to ascend and do too much. So the fear part is, fears often are expressed in your insults to each other, right? Insults can often become underlining factor of how you can tell what someone's afraid of or what a culture is afraid of. So for example, I'll take a Korean example because I can speak a little Korean. You know, to start a fight in Korea, call someone a puppy, right? Because it's a Confucian world over there. So you're not only subhuman, you're young. So that you want to fight, that's how you do it, right? In France, for example, being an inadequate lover, right? So if you spill milk in France, you'll say brothel prostitute, right? Bordel putain, right? You'd say brothel prostitute just for spilling milk, right? In Quebec, you'd use religious terms. You'd say wafer, tabernacle, chalice if you spilled milk, right? For real. that's a Quebec swear word, right? In America, of course, being a loser, right? Being a loser, terrible. Now, I mentioned all of these fears and everything because the opposite are the things that you believe so proudly about yourself, right? So in the case of Canada, we had this whole construct around, where are the peacekeepers? We're more democratic. We're more of this than America. And we had this whole sort of worldview based around the things we thought of ourselves. Now, what we didn't understand was that created all kinds of subconscious fears at the same time, the opposite of what we thought we were, right? We thought we were all these things. Like everything in the world, there's a black and a white, a positive and a negative charge to that. So all the things we thought we were have now actually, through entropy or whatever, become the opposite. Now, I'm not sure if it was ever true, right? I'm not sure if it was ever true. It doesn't really matter. More and more, you're seeing that Canada as a beacon of democracy, as a beacon of hope, as a beacon of this and that is not true. And the way you can sort of tell is because if you just look at the, let's call it the top-down nature of fiat currency, the problem with Canada, and I've said it for a long time, the problem with Canada is that top of the pyramid where the all-seeing eye is in that top-down model with the dollar at the top, The propagation nodes of that top of the pyramid thing are the media, they're the banks, they're the universities, it's credentialism. Fiat, of course, means a government decree, government declares, right? A declaration by these folks. And that's what we've made the most important factor in our democracy. So imagine, in our democracy, we've created a situation where the most important thing is what the experts or the credentialed people say, right? So the very much a top-down structure. And so Canada has kind of perpetuated this stuff for years. And we have more, for example, brainwashers per capita in Canada than in the United States. There's more, there's fewer people, but there's like a Canadian version of everything brainwashing in America. So Canada has created this situation where all of our fears seem to have manifested themselves in these really strange, absolutely dictatorial, absolutely fascistic tendencies, like we saw with the truckers, like we saw with, you know, a lot of things. And, you know, I've even come around, like I'm a Quebecer. I'm a 100% separatist now. Like, it's not even close, right? Like, I'm not even interested in Canada making it, right? Because it's dumb. And the reason it's dumb, and you can tell, go back to the beginning of Quebec separation in 95, not the beginning, but the last instance of Quebec separation. The leader at the time gave a drunken, some people say, speech when they lost and said he blamed the money and the ethnic vote. He said money and the ethnic vote is what made Quebec not a country. Now, if you've seen what that ethnic vote club has meant over the years, right? We've seen it with what's going on in the politics in the States. I'm a pro-immigration person, 100%, right? We need immigrants. They're usually better Canadians than the Canadians as far as understanding what they're here for, work ethic, and all that kind of stuff. But the club that's used in the media to say you're a racist if you don't go along with this thing was what was used for the Quebec separation case. But it was also money. And this is what really got me thinking, right? This is why it's not the country we think it is. So there was a sign in the 95 referendum, because one of the biggest debates that not a lot of people understood at the time, but I understood it, and my father explained it to me, and it was a problem. They used the we, which is yes. Yes meant to separate, right? And the signs all had varying ways of saying yes. They would just say yes, the political signs. And the way you spell yes in French is we, O-U-I, we, right? The O was used as some kind of logo. Sometimes it was a flower, a peace sign. It was all used to send political messages. But they had one very important one, which was, and this caused a lot of trouble, it was we with the loonie, the Canadian $1 coin, as the O, because they said, we can keep the Canadian dollar. We can keep it. And of course, Canada said, you can't keep that. That's ours. And so my dad told me at the time, he goes, what's the plan here? Are they going to go and like beat up every Quebecer and take their dollars away from them? Like, what's the plan? Like, you can say they can't use it, but what's the plan? Like, what are you actually going to do about it? Right. And I hadn't really thought of that at the time. I was like, wait a minute, that's a problem. Like, you don't want Canadians, even if they separate, they can't. Like, do you have US dollars? Can they go and take your US dollars because it's not your country? Like, of course not. The idea is crazy, right? Of course, Quebec could have used Canadian dollars if they felt like it. Well, why not? Right. So once you understand that they were willing to go down that road, I mean, you want to talk about the use of violence to take people's money. They explicitly said it in 90. Now, there was a whole brainwashing thing around that. We love you, Quebec. We're not going to do that to you. You know, well, sorry, not that we're not going to do that to the ones who agree with us. We love you who agree with us, who don't want to separate, right? So when you see all that stuff and you realize what's going on, and then you take this sort of Bitcoin thing, and you start to realize, wait a minute here, like this is not, we were threatening to go door to door and take people's money. We legitimately were as Canadians, right? So we didn't understand that about our country. We said at the same time, we're all these things. We weren't. And over time, the truth about what we thought we were has come to light. We are all these terrible, latent, subconsciously repressed. We're both. We're not just the sum of our bad parts. The good things exist too. Those are real. But it's all cyclical, and we've got to find another way to manifest those things and to kind of start over. So whatever we thought we were is dead. It's not coming back. We can salvage as much of what's there as we can, but I'm not bullish at all. Zero.
Hey, I'm one of the craziest.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, the things that we're seeing were probably there the whole time. We just weren't able to see them, right? They were probably there the whole time. So that's what I mean by it's not the country we thought we grew up in, right? It's quite a bit different. If a country in the 90s threatening physically to take people's money, it's a problem.
Yeah. And one of the weirdest things that's going on right now at this very moment is this main water main break in Calgary, Alberta. And there have been, so there's some kind of like citywide water restriction happening. But what's noteworthy about it is that there have been thousands of citizen snitch reports of people, you know, sort of ratting on their neighbors for using too much water. This is one of these things that revealed itself over the last 4 or 5 years for sure.
And I gotta not apologize, but look at how stupid Canada really is. I mean, people don't understand how poorly managed the country is, right? Think of the transfer payments and how egregious it is. Do you know how that stuff is calculated? No, I'll explain it to your audience. It's unreal, right? Quebec, I said at the beginning or earlier that energy is not just an input in your economy. It is the economy. So Quebec, in the deal they signed with Trudeau's dad, doesn't have to count its hydroelectricity. That's the largest public utility in the world, Hydro-Quebec. We produce so much electricity. None of it counts in our GDP. So on paper, Quebec looks poor. Because we're allowed to literally ignore our economy and just say, oh, it's the cafes. That's the restaurants. This is the strip clubs, right? That's Quebec. Just don't look at our incredible dams. They don't count. Meanwhile, Alberta has to count all of its energy output for its GDP, which is why they don't have good infrastructure, which is why they have water mains breaking. Because I'm telling you, I get new trains, I get new roads, I get new bridges, I get new everything here in Quebec. I mean, whatever we feel like, right? We have the best subway, the best everything. And we don't pay for it. Not even a bit, right? Not even a little bit.
So maybe just a final thought on Bitcoin and the wrapping up of traditional politics as we've known them over time.
Well, so, and I think it's important because Canada, as much as I've said I'm not bullish on Canada, I still think Canada is going to be amazing. It's going to do great. Maybe not the whole contractual entity of Canada. I think all the people will do great. But it comes down to this. Canada was created originally because America had just come out of the Civil War. They had invented all these new weapons. And England looked there and said, oh, we're not going for round three. Like, that's the end of that, right? They knew what happened in the Colonial War. They managed to get a victory in 1812 using Canadian soldiers and everything like that. But after, in the 1860s, when the Civil War ended, England went, you're on your own, you stupid people. Where America can take you, you're not worth it. Get out of here, right? We're not going to finance shit. We're not going to give you access to London capital. That's all over. So the reason Canada exists in the first place was to pool capital in order to build east-west infrastructure to prevent the north-south infrastructure that was coming to extract resources down to the United States, right? So British Columbia was Canada, Ontario, Quebec, and the Maritimes. There was nothing really in the middle. So that was the point, is to build the trains east-west infrastructure financed by a consolidated banking structure. So American federalism and Canadian federalism are almost exact copies. So state powers and federal powers, almost exact, except for banking. Banking became federal for the explicit reason that it was important to finance east-west infrastructure to avoid the Chicago trains and everything going up to Alberta and just sucking everything down, right? So they didn't know about oil and shit at the time, but they knew they needed to build east-west, which is unnatural because the natural flow of goods was north-south. So they consolidated banking. Now, that's what made the truckers thing so important. And I do think in the history of Bitcoin and the history of World War III or whatever is going on right now, the truckers protest in Canada and Canada in general will be seen as a kind of ground zero for the worst and the best. Now, when Canada decentralizes, when Canada renegotiates its federalism, when Canada capitulates on even having this federal power, I think what you're going to see is individual Canadian provinces become the most Bitcoin freedom loving, amazing individual states. But now remember that the big myth that Canada has never accepted or been able to intellectualize, except Quebec, is that it's not a A team, B team situation. They are equal, right? And just it's a separation of power situation. They are themselves states. Quebec is a state like any other, right? Like it's a country, it's a nation. And so when it's in charge of its own money, when it's not about consolidating the money to create the stupid Canadian dollar anymore, when it's not about consolidating the banks to de-risk the banks. That was the point. They couldn't afford a bankruptcy. They had to build it perfectly and right. The first time, that was Canada's only chance. That probably made sense, obviously, back in 1860, but entropy and system and whatever. So when I think of Canada, I think of the best case scenario to show how decentralized states can operate together in a type of confederation.
I think you're going to get a rejigging of the federal recipe, both in America and in Canada. I predict what you saw in Texas this year, for example, with their sedition on the border against the federal government, taking control of the border in Mexico and Texas. The federal government's never getting that back. They don't give those things back. That is now a state-administered border and is never going in the other direction. Now, when you see how all these states are dealing with the federal governments in America and Canada, they're all in the same situation. The federal government has the debt. The federal government borrows the money. The federal government collateralizes birth certificates and goes into debt using that system, right? That's them. That's why you're starting to hear these things about states like Texas issuing more or less a volcano bond. So I think what you're going to see is once the national currencies aren't enough to tie the country together, because Parizeau in Quebec was right. That is what kept the country from separating in 95. It was money. It was the money. It was the threats about the money. That freaked the Quebecers out. That was violence being threatened against them. That was, you're not getting a pension. You're going to starve as an old person. We're going to take away Canadian sound banking from you guys. Well, the good news is this time around, they've already destroyed Canadian bank. It's a fucking joke because of the truckers. No one will ever think this thing's credible anymore. I knew plenty of New Yorkers who were libtards and didn't care anything about truckers and vaccines, but they were Bitcoiners because they had a bunch of money in Bitcoin. And they said, I can't put money in Canada ever again. What are you talking about? Like that's now finished. Didn't have nothing to do with the politics. The politics didn't matter. It was so stupid what they did that it destroyed their credibility of their number one asset. And the thing that bound them together, remember that, again, that's the reason why we have a country. So a place like Canada, already bad neighbors to each other, right? Alberta has a ton of trouble building pipelines. They managed to get one into British Columbia. But again, remember, the point of Canada was finance, banking of east-west infrastructure. If we can't build the east-west infrastructure, then it's just for the banks. Then it's literally the point of Canada is to consolidate banking, which is not a reason for a country at all. And now that we're at this point, now that we're seeing these things, Quebec, once it can just leave the federal government with the debt, why were they not going to take the debt? We're just going to wrap it all up into some fake entity that is a corporation, and we're going to leave it there, right? So but the states aren't going to take, they're not going to assume it, right? They're going to inflate it to nothing and just leave it in the empty shell. So Quebec is very capable of issuing a volcano bond like El Salvador, right? Backed by their energy with some Bitcoin in the mix that is the financialized part of it. Texas is threatening to do the same. So you're going to see individual states use Bitcoin and their energy matrix in order to create a new, it's not really a currency, but a new financial foundation, a new economic foundation. So that's the future that I can see for Canada, because Canada has what it takes. I mean, Alberta with the energy, British Columbia with the energy, Ontario, amazing grid. I mean, Ontario's grid is amazing. It's amazing. Nuclear, hydro, and Quebec also amazing, right? So we have all these individual pieces. What we need to do is renegotiate the federalism. If it survives, fine, but it won't survive because of banking. And the major organizing principle was bank. That won't last. And because it won't last, Canada has this tremendous opportunity to go in the spirit of Bitcoin, which is decentralized. And a decentralized Canada has a chance, a real chance. And that's not because of the money, right? That's each individual state assuming more sovereignty and bringing the sovereignty closer to the individual. I feel like I've got better odds promoting my own personal sovereignty in a place like Quebec than I do in Canada.
Milton, this has been a fascinating rip, man. I appreciate you coming on to share some of your ideas. And we'll be sure to share your links to the show in the show notes. Is there anything else you want to sort of like leave as a parting thought or a place where people can find you online?
Yeah, well, I've got a couple books coming out this summer. So if your audience has any interest in science fiction, I've got some science fiction books that I'm going to be releasing, and I'm going to be putting an RGB++ minted asset onto it, a royalty token. So early fans, if they buy the book, or I'm going to experiment a few YouTube videos with the book and a QR code at the end to claim the tokens. The point is to get early fans who buy the book, like the book, and then suggest to others to buy the book, because all of the revenue that comes from the book will be put into a Bitcoin AMM, an automated market maker. So I'll inject all of the revenue from the book, turn it into Bitcoin, and put it in a pot. And the token that I give you when you buy the book as an early fan will be your rights to that percentage of the Bitcoin that's in the pot. So theoretically, you can read the book and you get this little token coupon that can be redeemed for Bitcoin if the sales are good, so that early fans can get rewarded, so that we can put an end to the hipster affectation of taking fandom away when you were early fans. I was a fan before they were popular. What we're going to get is people saying, like, when he got from buying the first book or going to the first concert. I call them artist royalty tokens. So could be the way people earn Bitcoin in the future. Good taste. Being early.
All right. And if you're listening to the show and you made it all the way to the end, I want to thank you for tuning in and hope to see you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.